I'd like first to just point to the title and subtitle of my paper and indicate that I see it as only initial reflections, a modest contribution to a panel, not definitive or complete answers. And without spending time on the paper as such, I'd like to come back to what I think are a couple of initial questions. First, I want to thank Sheldon Kutztag for making sure everybody has read the paper. And then I want to come at his question, which is a very valid one that he has now raised twice, and I've heard others raise on many occasions. Why are Christians not Christians? Why don't they apply the ideals that the native peoples equally believe in? And there's a deeper question behind that. What's religion got to do with this in the first place? Has religion got anything to do with native rights and colonialism? And shouldn't religion just back off and stay out of a field that's not theirs? So I'm just going to offer my personal suggestions, and they're going to hinge around that expression I used, perspectives of a liberating faith. And I want to spend a bit of time on what I perceive as a liberating faith. And in so doing, I will try to explain why I'm here in the first place and why I'm saying the things that I'm saying, and why I feel that in doing that, I am doing theology in the strictest sense of the word. When I say that I'm doing theology, I'm sharing with, I think, most human beings in searching for meaning. I too want to find a meaning for my life. I want to find those values that can give direction to my life and that can structure it. It is those values who tell us who we are and what our purpose in life is. And in this sense, I think it's not unfair to say that all peoples are basically religious in that deeper and broader sense, and that we all share these religious aspirations. So I start from the premise that I believe there are such things as lasting values, major values, transcendent values, if you will, that tell us that we have a past, we have traditions which have made us what we are, we have a meaning beyond simple physical survival or physical satisfaction, and we have a future. In other words, I believe there is a life beyond, and that I can establish relationships with all of you and all the other human beings who will cross my path that are not just relationships for today or tomorrow, but that are lasting relationships. And in that sense, every time we meet, we have affected our mutual lives eternally. That is my feeling. Because when I say there are lasting or transcendent values, I believe that I have relationships with a higher being, call that being God or some supreme power or whatever name you wish, and that these relationships are nothing less than a call to share in a life that is more than human, that I will call divine. And with all respect to all the other religions that have their own vocabulary and their own perceptions and their own language, my personal faith tells me that this supreme being, whom I call God, has not only revealed himself or herself, I won't get into that controversy at this point, in Christ, but that by accepting the revelation of God in Christ, I learn who I am as a human being, that I am really more than just merely human. My whole tradition, the biblical background out of which I come, and the experience of 2,000 years of Christianity based on the previous experience of thousands of years of my Jewish sisters and brothers, revealed to me that there are divine values that I share with others. Very briefly, these values are that God, the one God, is a God of life. A God of life, never of death. And that the divine corresponds with the life-giving and the demonic with that which deals death. I believe that all humans are made in the image of God, and out of that comes our fundamental equality. And then as a Christian, I make a step further and say that I have learned from my traditions that this equality is also an equality within a family, that we are all interdependent as members of Christ, and consequently, sisters and brothers in a deeper sense even than the bonds of blood. And called to live together forever. But the problem now arises when I see that this call to life, which I believe is extended to all human beings, is denied to some people. Why is it that in the name of whatever values, progress, efficiency, call it what you like, some people must die? When we know we're all called to life. And why is it that some people who are unable to enjoy the gifts of life because they lack the power to achieve their purpose in life? In other words, why are some rich? Why are some poor? Because I'm speaking here now of poverty in that sense of powerlessness. And it's not only economic. I can also be poor physically because I have no power to move the world around me and adapt it to my needs. It's not only poverty in terms of food, clothing, shelter, and health, but there's a much deeper poverty, for instance, at the social level, if society marginalizes me and says I am not important or discriminates against me for any reason, I am thereby rendered poor. In the sense that I am not given access to the fullness, the full riches of this universe. And even deeper, and I think it's very important to move beyond just this economic understanding of poverty that plagues our Western world and is part of the dilemma we're in, is to realize that the deepest poverty of all is cultural. And here when I say cultural, I'm including religious. Reina this morning said, who is us? Is who we say is us. And when others decide that a quarter or less than half of blood mix applied to non-whites is the reason why we're accepted or rejected, as Reina said, we have rolled over and died. We're already dead because someone else has the power to tell us who we are. That's cultural poverty. The inability to express ourselves, and maybe most of all, to celebrate ourselves, because ultimately the human being is human because the human being can celebrate. And here again, as I say, I'm including in cultural the religious dimension, and the questions are raised as much of religion as of culture, but that's too vast a topic to get into at this stage. Poverty can also be political. When others determine how power is going to be used, for instance, to organize society, this morning's example from Panama, United Fruit has power to set up a comarca to their economic advantage. In other words, they can decide what is the form of society, not the human beings. The power also to govern, and the power to relate to other societies, to decide how we as a people want to relate to some other people in terms of political relationships, etc. Now, one of the things that is becoming clearer to me as I go on is that the very perception of reality, the world around me, what is real and what is not, the very perception of reality is different for members of a dominant society and members of a weaker society. Because people who are poor have no power or control, like the example of mixed blood not applying to the whites. The reality is different. Our human blood becomes two types of blood. The one that is white that never mixes, and the other one that you can mix. So there is a very profound perception emerging now in more serious theological circles that reality can also be read from what someone has called the underside of history. Read most of our history books, they're written from, in a sense, above, by those who have succeeded. The powerful always succeed in battle, and it's always the savages who are crushed. Now, that raises for me a very profound question, and I go back to my own biblical inheritance, and I see that my God is a God who revealed himself as liberator on the side of the poor. And that's not only economic, but social and cultural as well. And that as a result, in my biblical heritage, dominant forces that impose themselves become idols. And I am called upon, with the full power of my religious background, to reject those idols as idols. And if there is a reason why religion has to be present in the economic, social, and political sphere, it's precisely because religion has the insights to detect the idols and to reject them. Because the idols inhibit or destroy life, they remove freedom, because the divine gives life, but the idol demands sacrifices and brings death. And you can apply that to any sphere. If an economic idol is set up, for instance, the almighty dollar, pushed to the extreme, it will demand sacrifices, and lives will be lost because of the almighty dollar. What we have here is not things evil in themselves. I do not believe in the Manichaean principle that all of creation is, you know, one part good and one part bad, and has to be black and white. And that's a continuing problem that plagues our history. We tend to always divide people into the good ones and the bad ones. You know, it's not the good and the bad. Good and evil cuts right through the heart of every human being. It's a question of values, good in themselves, that have gone wild. For instance, money, which becomes an obsession and begins to run lives. Pleasure, which becomes an obsession, and people spend their time entirely just pursuing pleasure, ultimately to discover that it is an idol and it destroys them. Prestige that has become worship, and it's fascinating to watch in our modern world when we claim that we've escaped the domination of, quotes, religion, we now set up heroes, human heroes, that really become idols and claim lives and are seen as superhuman. In fact, that cult of hero worship, as you know, is very destructive for the heroes themselves. Witness the suicides of so many celebrities, particularly actors, who are forced to live the life of the idol instead of their normal human life, ultimately realize they are appreciated not for who they are, but for the image they project, and eventually turn to despair. Many movies have been cast around that theme. Another value is power, which is a very useful and necessary thing. You know, I exercise power every time I move my chair to sit down. Without power, we cannot have life. But power can enslave me, and it can enslave others. As examples, technology, destroying human beings in the name of technical progress, which becomes an all-consuming master, you know, progress for progress' sake. You initiate something new technologically, and it has to be done because we can do it. I'm just thinking of the atom bomb. Or another example, possessive individualism that militates against the common good, and that's part of our Western inheritance from the Enlightenment gone wild, a good idea that once again has become an idol, and now it's for each one, each man for himself. That's possessive individualism, just too bad for the common good. I can make my millions and get out with my cobalt or whatever, and just too bad for the common good. That's my right That is fundamentally a possessive individualism of philosophy that came to us from the Enlightenment. Once again, it wasn't all bad. It has done some wonderful things, but it's gone wild and become an idol. Or ecological destruction versus the stewardship of resources. Do I have a right as an individual to cause ecological destruction that's going to be paid for by future generations? Now, the interesting thing is that people in possession, the powerful people, will not perceive these things, partly because their ideologies have taken possession of them, and partly because they do not suffer the consequences. It is the poor people who perceive these things and who reflect on their own poverty and the life-destroying forces in society, who are beginning to see that it is simply no longer acceptable. And that's why there's a whole new way of perceiving human values, or in other words, of doing theology, that is emerging precisely out of the poor people of the world. And this is not limited to one country. This is a universal phenomenon going on. So that the whole approach to doing theology now is not just working from theory from above, you know, whether they are Bible principles or philosophical principles or scientific discoveries or whatever, but an understanding of reality that comes out of the perception of how it affects life, leading to action in the light of faith or in the Christian perspective of gospel values. Now, the moment the poor people begin to perceive that reality need not be what it has been defined to be by the powerful, and they begin to say that, then the powerful are threatened, because it means there's going to be change. The status quo will not prevail. And consequently, the poor are always perceived by the powerful as revolutionaries. And the powerful will then immediately jump up and say, you have no right to use force. You have no right to become violent. Totally blind to the fact that they have been using force for centuries, and that they will, if necessary, use violence to keep the status quo. And we heard about invasions even with guns of peaceful villages in supposed democratic countries. And that's why the moment theologians begin to reflect from the perspective of the poor and to dare speak the truth from that perspective, they will be called revolutionaries, and then the powerful will find all kinds of ideological labels to slap on them in the hope of somehow stopping the movement of history. Now, the use of force is always ambivalent. Force is, as I said before, a value, a necessary value. But it's always ambivalent, and the ultimate question is not whether or not we should use force, but whether force will be used for the benefit of whom. The question is, on whose side will power be used? Because ultimately, power, force, is the capacity to decide. And here, as I said, it's ambivalent. It can become destructive. It can also be a call to freedom for responsibility. I am given certain powers, my talents, whatever capacities I have. They are gifts that I am called to use freely, in other words, responsibly. Because freedom is not license. Freedom entails responsibility. And the greater my freedom and the greater my power, the greater my responsibility to see that that power is used, that freedom enables me and those who relate to me to live more fully. If my freedom becomes destructive for others, my freedom has become an idol. And it's the role of religion to unmask it for what it is. In other words, freedom is to be used economically. Power is to be used for feeding, clothing, housing oneself and family. Power is to be used socially and culturally to interact, to develop relations, to worship, to use our own languages, and to express reality. I'll come back to that in a moment. And politically, power is used to govern, to organize, and to relate as groups in society so that we don't have chaos or anarchy. And I want to mention very briefly, just in passing, one of the most ignored of all powers, and that is the power of language. How reality is perceived and how reality is determined. For instance, if I have the power to apply the word civilized to myself and uncivilized to others, I'm exercising a frightening power. When the non-Europeans are defined, as we heard earlier this morning, as not being citizens, when racist determination puts its stamp on reality, then the power of language has indeed become an ideology. And by ideology here, I mean a limited truth which is made into the totality. And there's nothing more frightening than a limited truth which is expanded to englobe the whole of reality, because ultimately the logic of that means that I make myself God with the power to determine right from wrong, truth from untruth. And that's the whole lesson of the very origins of the Bible. What was what we Christians would call original sin? The temptation of Adam and Eve, the tree of knowledge of good and evil, precisely to substitute themselves for God, to substitute their will for God and decide what was good or wrong. Ideologies are necessary, and I don't want to give a negative connotation. They are limited views of reality because we're only human beings. We do not replace God. We are historic beings with a limited perception. We need those ideologies because the ideology is a source of energy. And as you know, religion is really the greatest source of energy because ultimately it touches the deepest values, my very definition. And that's why people will defend to death their right to determine their own culture. That's more important even than economic, social, or political power. And that's why oppressed peoples will survive or disappear depending on whether or not they clearly understand who they are. Witness a people like Poland. Why can Poland not be crushed by all the might of Russia? Is because the Polish people, in that sense, are somewhat unique in the world, have such a clear and powerful sense of their own identity. They have fought for 2,000 years, and they will never disappear. And ultimately, any of the native peoples who maintain clearly their own cultural identity will never disappear, and they will outlive the culture of the oppressor. Because the moment one nation becomes an oppressor, it denies its own ultimate culture. It betrays itself in its deepest heart, and it will not survive. Human beings cannot survive as oppressors, because ultimately they will create other oppressors who will replace them. It's the old problem of one dictatorship replacing the other that Freire has written about so eloquently. The greatest test of the revolution is not overthrowing the dictator. It's whether or not the oppressed can take power without becoming oppressors. Because the oppressed generally become worse oppressors for the simple reason that not having had power, they have not acquired all that historical wisdom and cultural expertise and so forth that allows them to see the common good. And they'll only perceive one narrow vision. And that's why so frequently in our own rising peoples, little minorities can in turn become very destructive because they have not got the wisdom and experience to perceive the common good. So they pursue only one narrow objective and eventually become oppressors of their own people. that has happened so frequently in revolutions, it doesn't have to be supported by any further evidence. And I come now to the question I constantly ask myself, why are some Christians not Christians? Because only that faith which transforms my life and my environment becomes a liberating faith. As I said earlier, religion is the most powerful energy there is in the world because it touches ultimate values, ultimate definitions, ultimate life. And that's why people so readily become fanatical for religious values. It's perfectly understandable. But it's also ambivalent, and it's a very dangerous force. And it can become even more oppressive precisely because of that. And the worst tyrannies are the ones exercised in the name of religion. So my faith must be a transforming faith. In other words, it calls me to full humanity, personal, family, social. And it must not be magic. The moment faith becomes magic, we have an idol. Faith is not magic, and that's why a Christian does not become a saint just by being baptized. Baptism is a call. It's not a free pass into heaven, and it is especially not an excuse from responsibility. On the contrary, it is a call to responsibility, a call to stewardship. And I have to constantly and very humbly look at my own faith, because if my faith is not critical, in other words, not prepared to look at the deeper values and critique my own conduct, if my faith does not constantly reassess what I am doing and continue to challenge me, if it does not lead me to transformation, then I will end up, like so many other people, in the name of Christianity, merely reinforcing the status quo. And when Christianity reinforces the status quo and becomes a defense of the political, it degenerates itself into a negative ideology. It reduces the understanding of reality to one dimension. It diminishes humanity and destroys freedom. And that's why there is no greater diminished humanity than the humanity of the fanatic, reduced to one narrow perception. All this has been written time and time again, and those of you who are familiar with the New Testament will recall how Paul and James and John and practically everybody said that faith without works is dead. In other words, a faith that does not transform society is a dead faith. And we come now to this problem of the colonial mentality. What happened? Well, Christianity degenerated in Europe to the point where it identified itself with European society, where it reduced human beings to an image of, quotes, European, close quotes, civilization, and then went out in the name of religion to civilize the pagans. In other words, Christians in Europe allowed their own faith to degenerate to the point where they considered other human beings as lesser beings. They forgot their own biblical origins, where they could manipulate them as objects, instrumentalize or exploit them, even destroy them in the name of Christianity. It happened in Latin America, where the cross too often came with the sword, and that's the big issue that we had with de las Casas, who saw this evil and tried to stop it. And that's not just an old problem, it's a historical problem that will be with humanity as long as we are human beings. It's not only yesterday that in the name of progress we destroyed other people. And if you want a modern exemplification of the colonial mentality and this betrayal of Christianity, it is when Christianity is identified with capitalism or democracy. You have a clear example there. The moment you have Christians defending capitalism as the ideal society in the name of Christianity, and not noticing that Christianity, like any religion, must always remain critical of any ideology, any political system, you have a classic example of the same colonial mentality. And that can be applied on the other side of the East-West dilemma just as well. The moment that I equate religion with democracy, I'm in real trouble. And I'm not saying that they do not have common values that they share, but we must not equate them. The moment we move from religion to politics and back and forth and identify the use of power, which is perfectly legitimate in the political realm, with the furthering of religion, we have misunderstood the very heart of the message that Christ brought to us. Because as I read my New Testament, I hear Christ telling me, in civil society, the powerful lord it over others, and they are called benefactors. But for you it not shall be, shall not be so. You shall be as servants, and consider yourselves as the last, like the Son of Man who came not to be served, but to serve, and to lay down his life so that his brothers and sisters might live. That's what I mean when I say that faith for me must be a liberating faith, and it's in that context that I wrote my paper and suggested that in the name of religion we have to unmask the realities of colonialism in the Western world, not be afraid to name the idols and call everyone to a deeper perception of what will truly contribute to justice and peace. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Bishop Daru. Sheldon?
I hope we both have accomplished a purpose, me by having the participants here make sure that they read the paper, so that we all understand what we're talking about. And you, Bishop Daru, for so ably presenting this theology of liberation. The pages 8 and 9 outline some four premises about this paper that really ably outline the basis for colonialism, not just in the Americas, but all over the world. And permit me to read a few of these so that those that do not have a copy of this paper can get an understanding of what we're talking about here. First, the colonial ideology that we see embodied in the corporate models for development, and I'll skip down to, was initially rooted in a Judeo-Christian view of creation, but took on a more rational scientific orientation during the Enlightenment. In so doing, it became detached from a sense of the divine mystery and a more holistic view of life. Second, this techno-industrial view of creation is essentially based on principles of domination. The central symbol is progress, and you can change that, if you will, to include growth. The imperative is to advance, to conquer, to control. Here, power is exercised in terms of the stronger over the weaker, the technical experts over laypersons. And this is the most important as far as the Alaska Native people are concerned, the corporate interests over local communities. Third, the techno-industrial view of creation also embodies a form of instrumental reasoning that distorts some of the basic meanings of life. In Aboriginal society, land was viewed as a gift of the Great Spirit. It was understood to be the common soil of social and spiritual existence, giving rise to the very values and institutions of society. Thus, the land itself and all it contains is to be revered, cared for, and cultivated for the lasting benefit of the whole community. Fourth, the techno-industrial view of creation is also imbued with a degree of European ethnocentrism. This is the dominant culture, and all other cultures must be absorbed or assimilated. We have seen this doctrine of homogeneity operative in policies and programs designed to assimilate Native peoples into the dominant society. Finally, the techno-industrial view of creation generates patterns of human relationships based on dominance and dependence, And again, I emphasize that this has great bearing on Native people here in Alaska and other places. In other words, the colonized people themselves, in this case the Native peoples, become defined as objects or commodities by the technical rationality that permeates the colonial ideology. The subjection of Native peoples to a condition of welfare and dependency is a more recent illustration of the cultural conflict we see, conflict we have described. This brings me to the condition of Alaska's Native people. Now, what recourse do we have? What can we do about this? The United States of America is a signatory, charter member of the United Nations. Chapter 11 of the Charter is a declaration regarding non-self-governing territories. And it, in Article 73, it states, members of the United Nations which have or assumed members of the United Nations, and as a charter member, I assume that the United States of America is a member, which have or assume responsibilities, and the federal government, as you well know, has assumed a great number of responsibilities with regard to the Native people of Alaska. For the administration of territories, which is territory of Alaska was prior to 1959, whose peoples have not yet attained a full measure of self-government, recognize the principle that the interests of the inhabitants, Alaska's natives, of these territories are paramount. In other words, they are the highest interests. And accept as a sacred trust the obligation to promote the utmost within the system of international peace and security established by the present charter, the well-being of the inhabitants of those territories, and to this end, A, to ensure with due respect for the culture of the peoples concerned, their political, economic, social, and educational advancement, their just treatment, and their protection against abuses. B, to develop self-government, to take due account of the political aspirations. That is important because there is nothing in the Constitution of the State of Alaska that provides for the political aspirations of Alaska's Native people as a separate and distinct people from the dominant society. Let me read that again. To develop self-government, to take due account of the political aspirations of the peoples, and to assist them in the progressive development of their free political institutions, according to the particular circumstances of each territory and its peoples and their varying stages of advancement. Article 74. Members of the United Nations also agree that their policy in respect to the territories to which this chapter applies, no less than in respect of their metropolitan areas, must be based on the general principle of good neighborliness, due account being taken of the interests and well-being of the rest of the world in social, economic, and commercial matters. Like I emphasize this point time and again. Everything, the justification is there. The ideals are set up. They're noble, very noble. But the practice, the execution, is where we're falling down. Our people are ignorant of all these rights that everything has been written about because we are expected. In the last 25 years since statehood, to absorb by whatever manner that we have at our disposal what the United States has been all about in the last 200 years. And at the same time, we are expected, because of all of this is in print, the Western society automatically assumes that we as Native people, since it is in print, since these are noble ideas, that we are aware of these things. And therein, you know, as I said earlier, therein lies the rub. We are expected to know all of these things just because they're in print. And no effort is made to make sure that not only that the dominant society provides for everything that they themselves have written with regard to a separate and distinct culture and people. And how do you, I think that's the overall gist of this particular roundtable. How do you get the dominant society to practice what they preach? Thank you.
Thank you, Sheldon. Oscar Coagley and then Robert Goldman.
I just want to make a few comments because I'm in full agreement with what Sheldon has to say. And since we're quoting the Bible a lot, I'll paraphrase one. Man will have dominion over all the creatures of the earth. In this case, man, I guess, would have to be the colorless ones, and creatures would include the colored, the natives, okay? And therein lies the dichotomy between the Western civilization and the native. The Western civilization is always man-centered. Man with his ability to make money. And the key word there is dominion, control, manipulation of nature. Whereas ours, I'm speaking from the point of view of the Yupik, we're ecology-centered. We consider ourselves to be an integral part of nature. And I think that is the biggest problem that we have, and we have to come to an agreement on that. And I think this is the reason why our tribal government or whatever form of self-government that we may have in the future is so important, because we want to have some degree of control over our own natural resources and what takes part. I think it's so very, very important because some things are happening within our own region. One of the mining companies, they've been fighting it for 2 years, and all of a sudden the state gives the go-ahead to go ahead and dredge and even redirect the river. And that is going to affect a lot of our salmon spawning. It's going to affect the animal life within that region. And this is why it becomes so important. I don't want really the eco side. See, I got to use that sparingly, like you said. Eco side. When I start to look at this here,